federally, Canada's Department for Women and Gender Equality, the WAGE, is facing budget cuts of 80% in their recently released departmental plan. The WAGE is a federal department committed to advancing equality with respect to sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression through the inclusion of people of all genders, including women, in Canada's economic, social, and political life. So there are a number of things the WAGE does. They create informational resources on gender equality. They provide reports on gender-based violence, provide consultation to other bodies of government, and overall set a standard for women and gender equality at the federal level. One of the more significant things the department does, which we feel at the community level, is provide funding, grants, and funding for organizations that focus on gender equality. As it stands, the WAGE's total budget, which represents 0.08% of the total federal expenditures, will fall to 0.01% by 2027, and staffing levels are expected to decline by 35.2% in the sector. So certain groups like the YWCA are circulating petitions about this budget cut, talking about how this could undermine the national and local feminist organizations, shelters, sexual assault services, victim services. So sitting with us in studio today is a representative from one of these organizations, the group Women Aware, which is a group that assists and empowers survivors who have experienced intimate partner violence. Clara, welcome to the show. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Women Aware?
Hi, thank you. I really appreciate you folks having us here again. We've, you know, done a lot of stuff with you guys in the past, and we love being back. It's just unfortunate that we have to talk about this, but we do. For those of you who are just tuning in and may have not heard of Women Aware and what we do, my name is Claire Levesque. I'm the vice president of Women Aware, Femme Avertie. We're a Montreal-based organization, a nonprofit that is run by survivors for survivors of intimate partner violence. And we service folks across Canada. You don't need to necessarily be in Montreal for us to service you. We have clients that are in BC, that are in Nova Scotia and stuff like that, that we service on our helpline, on our hotline, and also on in our one-on-one programs. So those are like some of the services that we offer. Our first line of contact is our hotline, where we have people that can either refer you to different resources. We have active listening, trained individuals. We also have a one-on-one peer support service where we listen to the survivors and what their needs are, what their case is, and then they could be paired with somebody that has a similar lived experience. And we also have group support, among other things. We do advocacy, we do sensitization or sensibilization of what gender-based violence is to the general public. So we do a variety of things, and we're there on the front lines working with survivors, but we're also there trying to prevent, you know, this from being a common day experience, whether it be with high school individuals or with partner organizations that don't know how to intervene. We're there. So
part of what you do, not just listening sessions and support, but also information campaigns.
Yeah. Right. So like, you know, if say a family member of a survivor calls our hotline and they're like, hey, yeah, I have a cousin who's experiencing this and it's been ongoing. I have no idea what to do. How do I support them? Because it's killing me seeing them, you know, go through this. And, you know, we can give them advice. We can refer to them to different resources for both their mental health, but also to, you know, do's and don'ts in that situation, because we don't want to further put the survivor in a situation of unsafety, and we don't want them to also shut down and then not want to keep in contact with the person that's trying to help them, because that'll sometimes happen, right? Is, you know, the cycle of isolation. That's exactly what an abuser wants. They want their person that they've chosen to feel alone. So we do things like that, but we also go to, like I said, partner organizations. So like, say, for example, somebody mainly works with, like you guys were talking about, substance abuse, people who experience substance abuse. Sometimes there's a lot of overlap with people who are survivors of conjugal violence or intimate partner violence. So if they don't know how to kind of, or they're not trained in how to address that from a trauma-informed perspective, they can partner with us to have training.
I'm wondering for the aspect of helping someone who's going through this as like a bystander or a cousin or a friend, how do you do it? Because it's very difficult. It's very much a mental health game for these people, these victims that are going through it. It's, and as you say, mm-hmm. it's like a manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it. It's very difficult to I wouldn't say reason with someone who's going through it, because it's mm-hmm. very difficult, and I understand that. But there's how do you do it to not be isolated, to not lose contact with the person? Because, of course, it's not ultimately their choice. It's a very difficult situation
mm-hmm.
That people don't realize they're being manipulated. It's not your cousin's fault. It's not your friend's fault who may be going through a situation.
Yeah.
So how do you tell someone who wants to intervene how to intervene in a respectful way that could maybe push the victim out of the situation, or even just keep the connection of staying friends and having mm-hmm. a support system?
I really appreciate that question, because, you know, it's exactly questions like that for the reason why I disagree vehemently in so many other women's organizations across Canada with the budget cuts that are expected, the 80% across the next several years for the Against Gender-Based Violence Initiative, because there are, you know, what you're describing is what you call vicarious violence. So for those of you who don't know the definition of what vicarious violence is, when somebody who's very close and emotionally invested in somebody who is directly experiencing the violence witnesses it in some way, shape, or form, and then they, because they have, empathy, they feel the anguish, what you're describing, those feelings of deep pain seeing them this way. So friends can experience vicarious violence. Roommates can experience vicarious violence. Children can experience vicarious violence when we're talking about domestic violence, if they're seeing their parents, but they're not directly getting the violence per se. And where are the mental health resources for that? So I just wanted to kind of like mention that, is that these are the types of things that are going to get affected in terms of funding. And that's going to put a damper, that's going to put more strain on both the health system, on our economic system, and on the judiciary system. It's all interconnected. So to invest in gender-based violence initiatives and the fight against gender-based violence initiatives, it's tied together. But to circle back to your question, how do you support someone who is experiencing that? What we always recommend is, you know, the first thing you can do is document everything from afar. You know, obviously don't tell the person that you're documenting it, because the thing is, when the person is in it, they're not thinking about that. They're just thinking about making it through the day, making it through the hour sometimes. And that can take many different forms. And so sometimes just documenting the day, the time, something that happened, like, for example, say in the example of being a cousin, you notice that, or your cousin disclosed to you, oh yeah, you know, he yelled at me today. He called me an effing this. And then he proceeded to throw out my favorite painting. You can document that for them. And then after that, once they're ready to exit the relationship, but they can't for some reason recall or remember the instances of abuse, you have that for them. You're like, hey, I witnessed this with you. And so that's an example. As you know, as I mentioned, we're a survivor-run organization. You know, when I was in my past abusive relationship, you know, I did eventually keep some texts. I have a lot of them. And I have emails and everything like that, call logs. But something I remember was my old landlady, you know, and, you know, I didn't feel comfortable ever going to the police about it. But, you know, she came up to me once I exited, and when she confirmed that I exited and saw I was in an abusive relationship, she's like, you know, I documented, I heard everything that happened through the floorboards, and I documented everything. if ever you want that or need that, I have it here for you. I felt very unnerved by it at the time. So, you know, I was just fresh getting out of it. So that's also its timing. So as a supporter, try to gauge the timing. And that's very hard to do, but see where the person is emotionally. So that can take the form of, you know, what we call active listening. And it could take the form of asking them, how do you feel at this point in time about talking about this? Do you ever feel you would go to the police? And if their answer right away is no, then maybe it's not the right time to say, oh, by the way, I have evidence, you know? And the best thing you can do is ask. And to just ask questions, facilitate a discussion with a survivor, that might look like, how did that make you feel when he threw out that favorite painting of yours? And just by you validating their feelings and telling them, hey, that sounds like a really painful experience. You know, if somebody had done that to me, I would have probably went crying in the bathroom. You know, you're telling them, yeah, that's not okay. And I'm here with you. And I want to hear about what you're going through because I believe it's not okay. Something mm-hmm. as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of answers and resources that Women Aware provide for people mm-hmm. and the partner organizations you work with as well. So can you tell us a little bit about your fears when it comes to this budget cut? What might your organization and the partner organizations you work with look like if we were to see a reduction in these grants, if the money were to stop coming at the federal level?
Well, I mean, we're already feeling the effects. Like, we risk, you know, closing our doors if we don't find funding quickly within the next, you know, several months. So, you know, if you are good at grant writing, please do reach out to us. If you want to donate, please do reach out to us. You can call us at 514-489-1110. We're open Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. If not, you can also email us at info@womenaware.ca. We do have a charitable organization registered number on our website as well, so you can check that for donations and whatnot, monetary donations specifically. What can that look like? Well, it just means that we won't be able to stay open and continue running by survivors for survivors. There's very, very few organizations across Canada like ours that exist. We're very unique in that sense. But just to kind of give you some numbers, in the judiciary system alone, it costs about an estimated $7.4 billion to deal with the aftermath of spousal abuse. Now, when we're talking about those billions of dollars, what can that look like? Well, I mentioned part of it, vicarious violence, psychological services, and things like that. It could look like the incarceration system. It can look like persecutions, courts, legal aid, which, you know, oftentimes survivors don't have equitable access to because they're in situations of financial need or whatnot. It might look like child protection services, protection orders, like what do you call those?
Restraining orders.
Restraining orders. Thank you. I was having a blank right there. Separations and divorces. And these things extend over years. So that's what risks happening, because programs like that, where certain legal aid programs across Canada and Quebec were helping survivors, might risk getting their funding cut because wage helped out with that. Other aspects of gender-based violence that could be affected by it is also part of wage was to invest more in the intersectional aspect of how gender-based violence disproportionately affects people. Because when we talk gender-based violence in the past, it was always, oh, happening to cis women. So a lot of services that were just starting to address, oh, LGBTQIA people are affected. Oh, people with disabilities are disproportionately affected. Programs like that risk getting their funding cut. And especially when we're talking about medical abuse and people living with disabilities, there aren't very many resources across Canada that address the intersection of that. So how are we doing them justice and service by cutting this funding to them? It's all interconnected. And like I said, it's going to be a domino effect. It's not just, oh, this is nice to have, as an open letter that was circulated stated. This is vital. This is life or death for people.
So we're sitting here live in studio with Clara from Women Aware, and we're discussing budget cuts to gender equality initiatives and gender-based violence initiatives. And you were saying that there were a few more statistics you wanted to share with us before the hour ends.
Yeah, so just a little trigger warning to folks. I know this has been a very heavy episode, but I am going to share some numbers related to deaths and things like that in a moment. So if you do need to take a moment to walk out of the room, take a moment. I know this is heavy. Alone in 2024, femicides in Canada affected about 187 women and girls that were reported and that were violently killed. And I say reported, it's very important, because this is not including the missing and murdered Indigenous women. This is not including women who, or, you know, gender-based violence where people took their own lives because they felt that there was no other option. They had no way out. So those things don't tend to get reported. That represents a 27% increase in femicide cases compared to 2023. So I highly implore the government to reconsider that decision. If this were some of their children, what would they think of that? And just to also speak, we talk gender-based violence, but it's, like I said, doesn't just include women. Men are also affected by gender-based violence, men and boys. We can't get into a whole discussion about it right now, but those are also things that are going to be affected and probably cut across Canada. And just in Quebec alone, services that are specific and tailored for men experiencing gender-based violence, there's only about 3, maybe 4 in the whole province that are specifically tailored. So, for example, people can call SOS Violence Conjugale, there's Réseau Maison Oxygène, there's the support for sexually assaulted men in the Estrie region, the Centre de Ressources pour Hommes du Sud de la Naudière. And those are the only ones that are, you know, kind of covered by the government. The rest are sometimes community-based organizations just trying to do their best and trying to get grants and stuff. But this is what we need to consider.